Hello, thank you for downloading this podcast of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. We hope you enjoy listening to this. For more information about our programs, please visit www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.
So, welcome. It's such an honor to sit with you and be in conversation with you. As someone who grew up in the 80s and the 90s, I realized I had so many questions because we've grown up watching your films and actually watching you on TV as well and on print. But it's really an honor, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation. So just
it's an honor for me because I can go home and tell people I was at NYU. Did you know that?
But what I wanted to do, and I hope the audience also would like that, is I wanted to sort of walk through your entire journey through cinema, through the all the films that we have watched, because each film is so distinct in terms of both genre, but also the industries that you have traversed. And being a filmmaker myself, I have some filmmaker type questions as well. So I'm hoping that we can just sort of have a conversation. I do have a long list of questions, but I shall keep that aside as we go along. But I wanted to really just begin with a very basic question about, you know, cinema in your childhood. What was the connection, your journey towards cinema? I know you had many detours. We all know that you've been a chartered accountant, you've been a model, you've been an actor, eventually became a director. But if you can just walk us through that journey a little bit, as much as you would like to share with our audience.
Well, the first film I ever saw was Tarzan.
Oh.
And I was in modern school in Delhi, and right next to it was Sapru House, remember, where they used to show films. So I guess I was fascinated by the fact that it was a full house, unlike today, but it was a full house, and I was just sitting there watching everybody respond to this guy going, aah! I thought, what an amazing idea to make films and get people get involved and make them emotional. I think the seed was formed there, but then I forgot about it. Then I went to school. And then all I wanted to do was to go to London, because who didn't want to get away from India those days? I wanted to go to the center of the universe, and the center of the universe was where the Beatles were, where the Rolling Stones were. So I wanted to go to London, I went there. And the only way I could get there is by agreeing to be a lawyer, a doctor, or a chartered accountant. So I agreed to be a chartered accountant, and when I finished, I knew I wanted to leave. I did not want to be a chartered accountant. But everybody says, so you left being an accountant and you went and joined the movie business. And people come to me and said, you know, some filmmakers come, so we've been struggling for 2 years, we haven't made a film. For all of them, I'd like to say that between the time I left London and made Masoom was 12 years. So it takes time. It takes commitment. It takes adventure. It takes foolhardiness and a lot of stupidity. It takes everything, all of that combined into one great act of creativity. But I left London to find myself. And I know that's become a term that everybody uses. What are you doing these days? Oh, I'm finding myself. So, yeah, but I did. I really did. I left to discover who I am. That was it. And on the way, many adventures later, I discovered myself as a bad actor. I discovered myself as an unreasonable person. All kinds of things I discovered until I discovered Masoom. Right. And people ask me about Masoom, and I said, if you ask me how it happened, I have no idea. Yeah. I did not make a film before that. I hadn't read a book. I hadn't gone to film school. I did not assist anybody. I knew nothing. And now that I'm making what people are calling a sequel to Masoom, so let me go back and see how I did that. And when I looked at it, I realized, I can't tell how I did that. And I know something about creativity is that creativity is an aspiration. Creativity is a longing. Creativity is a desire to find the infinite within your own finite self. Now that's complicated, but it's true. But what happens out of that longing is not you. Yeah. It's something that happens. It's an event that happens because you have the longing. So the passion, the longing is the more important thing. And out of that, you say, acha, hum, camera here. Look, put the camera here. Write the scene. Something happens. But that happens out of what you create through. You are not creating it. It's just because you're passionate and you're crazy and mad. That's also part of being creative. Sorry, I spun ahead.
No, that was lovely. But I actually, even though you might not remember how Masoom happened, I do want to sort of again for members in the audience who were not born at that time, which would be most of our students. But you know, Masoom is an important film for a variety of reasons. One is in 1983, Hindi film cinema, commercial film cinema is totally immersed in melodrama, in epic films, but you make a film that's working with the syntax of realism, which itself is a shock and a disruption. At that time, the parallel cinema was there, which was really the cinema exploring realism. But then most of those films were exploring the subaltern. They were exploring oppressed communities. So here, suddenly, there's this film about relationships in a middle-class family, working with the idiom of realism, but also thinking about a very nuanced kind of storytelling. And then you're working with the stars of parallel cinema, whether it's Shabana Azmi, Nasiruddin Shah, Saeed Jafri. So it suddenly is disrupting both. And I find that a very important thing that Masoom did. So, you know, just to take you back to that time when you came up with this idea of this kind of a film that's exploring human relationships, you know, what was the response of, let's say, the commercial producers or the parallel cinema NFDCs of the world? Were both of them skeptical, accepting, rejecting? What was that all about?
I think my conflict with the parallel filmmakers came after Bandit Queen, not before that. Uh-huh. But while I was making Masoom, I was not conscious of anything of these things. It came out of people I saw. If you go to Delhi, everybody tells you lies about themselves, right? And everybody will say, I work with the government. I just met Narendra Modi yesterday. Yeah. All of that goes on and on and on. That's what Delhi was about. Those days, everybody said, what did you do, sir? Export, import, sir. And so Saeed Jafri, yeah. I created Saeed Jafri after this. That's man who's saying, lovely. What do you do? Export, import, yeah. And then what I find in still is very relevant in places that we live now is, it's all about, what do you do? Oh, I know so-and-so. Hmm. What do you do? I know so-and-so. Do you know I know so-and-so? Are wo to apne aadmi hai yaar. You know, all that goes on. It used to go on in Delhi all the time. So those lines that from Saeed Jafri came saying, contacts, DK, contacts is everything, sir. So all of that came. The kids were dressed in the same school that I have, modern school. I went there.
Oh, wow.
And that you alu, you tinda, you vegetables, I ate it.
Yeah,
you
know, so
things just evolved out of what I knew. And thankfully, I did know enough, not too much, because if I knew too much, then the film would have never ended. Yeah. I just made the film. Just made a film. That was it. I did not carry any burdens of, look, I have to make a successful film. Nasir was... I'll tell you something. Every film of mine that people have said, this is a terrible script, I don't know why you want to make it, has become a really good film. They said that about Masoom.
Yeah.
They said that about Bandit.
They is who? Who said Masoom is a terrible script?
Govind Nilani.
Oh, okay. The parallel cinema.
People that I knew, that I trusted, they were friends of mine. He says, there's no drama in it. There's no melodrama in it. Where's the villain? I said, Destiny?
Yeah.
Destiny is the villain, if you like. If the antagonist is Destiny, because that's what happens.
Yeah.
But I didn't know. So at one point I said, I either have to listen to them or I just have to make the film. And I made the film. But I remember they said the same thing about Bandit Queen. Nasir actually turned down Bandit Queen because he said, Shekhar, I've even tried to read the script. I don't know what's going on. Everybody said when they read the script of Elizabeth, they said, you're making a documentary, you're not making a feature.
Mm.
So now I've decided that if people like my film, I better like my script, I better not make that film.
Masoom is also so memorable for one more reason, which is, I think this was the first time in Hindi cinema that you had three children protagonists who were children, who behaved like children, who didn't mouth very adult lines or these sugary, syrupy, sweet lines. Children were being who they are, mischievous, unmindful of things, very sensitive, all of that. And the film is imprinted in most of our memories, not just because of these fine actors, but these three children. This is my curiosity. What was it like directing these three children who I know who had no experience before that? And
neither did I. But what I did with children, and then Mr. India with children again.
Yeah.
Is I just let them do what they want and shot it.
Lovely.
I just let them. I mean, my camera moved as they moved. If you tell kids what to do, they'll go like that. We have to act well. I just follow them around and I let them, they change their own lines.
Yeah.
I just use those lines. So a lot of what you see with the children is just me following and seeing what they do.
Mm.
And luckily I had two actors that were not fazed by it. Both Nasir and Shivana were not fazed by what the kids were doing because they were so good at what their own craft.
Right. Yeah, it almost felt at that time, but even now when you look back, it felt like a group of friends had come together and had really put their hearts into making something that's going to live long. So it's very exciting to know that there might be a sequel to Masoom, but we'll come to that later. So I want to now move from 1983 to 1987, right? Yeah, 1987. And now you change course entirely and come up with a film. Before we go to 1987, I do want to remind the audiences that Masoom was both a commercial success and was critically acclaimed, right? It was accepted by both sides very enthusiastically. But then between 83 to 87, you come up with another surprise, which is a hardcore masala commercial film called Mr. India, again with top stars of the time, Anil Kapoor and Sridevi. I didn't forget her name. I suddenly was like, how many people were in that film? I cannot forget Sridevi, but yeah. So you had these amazing actors. You had a totally different take. It's a crackpot science fiction film in the middle of Bollywood, but someone like me who likes to read into films, I keep thinking Mr. India is interesting and unlikely counterpoint to Mother India, Nargis's Mother India, not because of the style or anything in the content, but both are in a sense representing that common person, that common citizen of India. And here was a completely wacky story of this common citizen of India who has a power to become invisible and then subvert and bring about change. And if that's my professorial reading into the film. But the film, again, we were children at that time, was so much fun. So from a very, very delicate, nuanced relationship story to a full-on, I'm sorry to use slip it to Hindi, but a full-on maja film, what was that about? How did you convince commercial producers that you were the man for this film? How did you come about the script?
It wasn't the same script, but the idea of doing Mr. India was brought to me from Boni Kapoor.
Oh, really?
And I'm sure it was because there were kids in it, and he's seen Masoom with kids in it. But then, of course, we worked on the script. We completely changed the script. We completely changed the nature of the film, sitting with Javed and I. And at that time, Javed also had this madcap idea. I mean, who else would write a dialogue like when Anil Kapoor, I don't know how many of you remember the film, but when Anil Kapoor is trying to sell the apartment to rent to Sridevi, and he said, "Is ghar ki khoobsurati ye ki ye seedhiyan upar jaati hain aur yahi seedhiyan upar se niche aati hain." And the whole audience was laughing. And where, how does a man even write that?
So just a quick translation for those who don't know Hindi or Urdu. The character says, trying to sell this house to a tenant, that the staircase goes up, and believe it or not, the same one comes down. And that's the line.
So I actually decided, because I always look at my films in an audience way. Somebody in the audience, I know someone person in the audience. But in this case, the audience member was sitting with me. It was an 11-year-old. Me. It was a mini-me, 11-year-old kid called Shekhar Jr. sitting next to me. Mm-hmm. And every time I would shoot a shot, I would say, would you like it? Oh, God, that's so boring. Oh, shit, I better do this again. So I had a constant conversation going on with this 11-year-old kid sitting next to me all the time. Because I had to find a way to make myself a child again. So I created a child. That was me, that I was constantly conversing myself. And that's how I made the film. It's from the point of view of that child.
Lovely. And it was, again, a huge commercial success. But here again, I have two...
I did not expect it. I thought I was making a children's film. I did not expect it to become such
so
a
popular.
Big hit.
But again, now I have two film student type questions inserted in. One is, of course, again, to tell the audiences that this was a film which needed a lot of special effects. But unlike today, which is all computer generated images or, you know, effects that are done after you finish shooting, this film is famous for its in-camera effects that, in fact, I read a beautiful interview with the person who did that, Mr. Pereira. But if you could speak about that, because again, with not that much training in filmmaking, you are willing to take such brave leaps into the unknown and, you know, come up with your own vision.
Well, because I was dealing with a character that was could become invisible, so music helped a lot. There was a certain pattern or a certain note that would come up on screen. Everybody said, oh, where is he? He's there somewhere, we can't see him, you know. But there were things that we did, like one shot, five passes of the negative.
Wow.
You couldn't do that with the Nariflex, but we could do it with the old Mitchell camera. So mask the camera and then roll back exactly, and then shoot it, and mask it a different way. And that was a scene in which he first discovers invisibility.
That he can be invisible.
He can be, and then he picks up the kid, runs. But there is one scene that nobody discovered how I did it. It's like the Invisible Man, Mr. Inde comes into a room. That's simple. A door opens and closes on its own. He sits on a chair. That's simple. You just put a little lever down and the chair gets depressed. But a Coke bottle comes in, he picks up the Coke bottle and he puts a straw in the Coke and he drinks the Coke bottle. And everybody said, how did you do that with the Invisible Man? Now that was easy. That was not that easy. But what we did was I took a huge, large, clear glass panel, stuck the Coke bottle in that.
Oh, okay.
Made sure, and then took some grease and fuzzied up the top half of that. And then painted the walls the same wall as the string. And so when the straw came in, the top half of the straw coming in, you didn't see because it was a little greased up. So you didn't notice that. And the straw went on and on and on. The outside of the camera was my assistant sucking up Coca-Cola.
So
you saw it up to a point and beyond the grease. But it was something. Sometimes it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
It was just a clear glass with a little bit of grease in it, and you didn't see it. And then you get the right colors and the right lighting for the people not to say, "Acha, upar kya?" You don't notice it. You see the action.
You're seeing the action,
And always remember, visual effects don't sell. It's the actor's reaction that sells. So I had Anu Kapoor, who's a great actor, on the other side going, what's that? So it's always
scene.
The actor's reactions that sells. Even if you see Marvel or any one of these big films, it's the actor's reactions to the visual effects that sells the visual effect.
And not the fanciness
not
of the computer generated image. Yeah. No, and Mr. Pereira in his interview says, it's a lovely line. He says, Shekhar would come with yet another madcap idea, and then we would sort of get excited and how to execute it. And, you know, in the film, you cannot imagine that it's all in-camera effects, because that's really difficult to get. But I had one more...
We had puppeteers from Rajasthan.
To help with the... Oh, okay. Yeah, it's amazing.
Just outside, yeah.
Another question about Mr. India is really... You, in your previous film, you worked with the top parallel cinema actors, method actors, very much invested in their craft. And then you have Mr. India, where you have these stars, brilliant actors, but in a very different genre, with like Sridevi, Anu Kapoor, Anil Kapoor. What was that like, dealing with these two very different types of actors?
Well, Sridevi is a lens stealer. Mm-hmm. She's always like that, you know. She would be sitting there saying, like that. And you suddenly say, okay, action. Suddenly they used to see a force coming out of her. Just some strange energy would overtake Sridevi. And I saw that in another film. So I was pretty sure that if I needed somebody to take the attention from visual effects away, it was her. Yeah. And then, of course, then we used her in the dance and we used her in the way. She was just quite... She's the perfect comic book actor. And Mr. India was a comic book film.
Right.
Right? She was a perfect comic book actor.
True, yeah. No, that and I think this film is the first time you realized her comic potential.
Yeah.
She went on to do other films, but I think this was the first time she wasn't just a beautiful, sexy woman, but actually a brilliant comic actor.
I remember going to her. One day I had this idea. I went to her. I said, Sri, you look terrific in a moustache. She kind of looked at me and said, what? I said, I think I want you in that scene where you go into the den, into the casino, I want you dressed and act like Charlie Chaplin.
Well, that's such a lovely scene.
So she put on a moustache and she hadn't seen much. I think for 1 week she sat every day watching Charlie Chaplin scenes, every day, films, and then came out and did the perfect impersonation of Charlie Chaplin.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that scene is imprinted in all our hearts. So yeah, so that's 87. 87 to 94, there were lots and lots and lots of publicity and rumors about you working on this film and that film and that film, and nothing materialized. And then
I was fired. I've been fired of more films than I've actually made.
They couldn't handle your vision and
I'm not that easy a person. Yeah, so I got it fired.
Good for you, because then you went on to actually again bring a completely different film into the Indian cinema scene, which was Bandit Queen. Again, for those who might not know, Bandit Queen is a really important film for a variety of reasons, but one being that this was a film based on the life of a person who was living, who had been a bandit, and then at the time you made the film, had actually renounced that life and come into the life of politics with a huge, there was a huge popular mass behind her, and this is a very controversial person, and you made Bandit Queen, this time with entirely new set of actors, all young NSD graduates, who again brought a very different style of acting into the scene. The film is based on a book. If you could speak about how did you even reach that point where you said, okay, this is my next film?
I was offered to be a co-producer. I said, no, I don't know how to do that. Then they said, okay, would you make a documentary? And I said, I don't know how to make documentaries, but I could make a feature. They said, could you make a feature in the same budget as a documentary? I said, yes. That's as simple as that. Yeah, that's why I did that. But the form of the film happened because I went to the area where Pulan Devi was, and I understood the environment a little bit. And I got very angry because I was living in Delhi and all of that was happening about 100 kilometers away from where I was. And all we used to hear about Pulan Devi was a little third, fourth page little item that this happened to this woman and this happened. And then with every film, you have to decide, why are you making that film? I tend to become every character that I make in the film myself. Or somewhere it comes, arises, I have to find it. I then realize that the reason to make that film is to say that rape is a political act. Rape is not a sexual act. Rape is an act of domination and humiliation. And then I said, well, men do that. And I realized that mostly men who rape have lacked self-worth. And I realized, that's me. I was brought up as a Punjabi boy with this idea of masculinity, becoming a big burden. And what were we taught? A girl has to be shy. Man has to be aggressive. And I thought, that's a product of what happened to her. So I decided that I will reveal myself as a man in the film. That's why it turned out like that. It was tough. It was tough to constantly reveal yourself, constantly. And I decided I was going to make it very real. So I'm going to tell you something here that will shock you at what a filmmaker has to go through. There's a scene in the film where Pulan Devi as a 12-year-old was married to a 30-year-old man, a pedophile. And on the first night, he rapes her. I have to shoot that scene. How do you do it and do it real? How? And not shy away from it. You've got to do it because that's fundamentally formed the basis of her character. I had a noisy set, small, very set. And it was very noisy because my brilliant DOP who's passed away, probably one of the most brilliant DOPs in the world, was Ashok Mehta. But he was very noisy. He was screaming, shout at everybody, and everybody screaming and shouting. And I'm thinking, how do I shoot this scene? So I look at her, this 11-year-old girl, who said, always like Shekhar Uncle. You know, I found her, or Tigmanshu, who's my casting director. It was a family of people on the streets that were singing and making money, and she was part of that family. So we brought her on, and she was the one who did the young Pulan Devi, and I looked at her. And I said, what would cause me to be sexually attracted to an 11, 12-year-old girl? Can I? Do I have it? Are we all have all, everything within us? And I'm staring at her and staring at her and staring at her. So Shekhar, while the noise is going on, you have to decide the first shot. You don't have that much time. You have to decide how you're going to shoot the scene. And as I'm staring at her, trying to understand how a man could find a 12-year-old sexual or be a pedophile. Suddenly, I noticed that the whole set went quiet. And I looked around myself and I saw this young girl, her eyes were full of fear. And all I was doing was she walking towards her and she was backing away from me. And I suddenly realized, and that became the first shot of this man walking towards her and she's backing away became, and then the whole scene developed from that. But so what is it that we do to ourselves as filmmakers, you know? So I'm just telling you how honest I had to be with everything that I did in that film, because otherwise the film of such a valid political, psychological context would have been a lie. I didn't want it to be a lie.
And the film, what one remembers or takes away from it is a certain kind of rage that you felt that anybody could be in this situation. But what I also wanted to ask about that film is that, you know, caste violence continues in our country and unabated, unfortunately, and so many years later. If you were to make a film like Pulan Devi again, would it be very different? Would there be a different perspective? How do you even think you might make a film with that kind of gritty realism and looking violence and oppression directly at its face as Bandit Queen did?
I was involved with one, then I decided not to make it, but I'll tell you that. But you know what, when it's not a filmmaker. A filmmaker will be lying when you take up a film like Pulan Devi and resolve it.
Yeah.
If you start giving films like that resolution, it's a lie. You can make Deewar and give it a resolution. You can make Mr. India and give it a resolution. You can take Masoom and give it a resolution. But when you're taking and making a film of that political importance, the biggest lie you can say is the central problem the film has resolved itself. Mm-hmm. As you just said, it hasn't.
Yeah.
The other one, after Elizabeth, I spent a year and a half in South Africa because I was asked to make a film on Mandela.
No.
And I kept saying, what is the importance of Mandela? What was the importance of Pulan Devi? Mandela is not important on his own. Mandela is important in the context of apartheid. And he had written a book called Long Walk to Freedom. Yeah. And Long Walk to Freedom was written when he was in prison, and I know it was edited by the ANC and then released to the world. So it wasn't the original.
Mm.
The edited version came out. And I kept saying, this script that you're asking me to make feels like somebody sitting by a swimming pool in Los Angeles writing the film, because it just doesn't have the anger that one should feel against apartheid.
Yeah.
I could never work it out. I still can't work out when did we all decide that the brown skin or the black skin is lesser than white skin? How the hell did it happen? I'm still like, when? How?
Mm-hmm.
And it was desperately needed in that film to understand the story of apartheid through the story of Mandela. And then finally I said, look, I can't do this film because it's too important a subject for me to just make an overview of Mandela's life, which is what was in the script.
Right, like
if you cannot ask that question, you cannot make the film. So I have left films because of that too.
Mm-hmm. So would this have been the first film that you considered making after Bandit Queen and then rejected it?
No, after Elizabeth.
Then, oh, after
then,
Elizabeth.
Then
okay.
The producer said, I got fired.
Yeah, yeah. Because
the producer said, there's enough, Shekhar. We can't keep rewriting the script. Yeah.
Mm. So then after Bandit Queen, sadly, Bombay lost you and you went back to London. But in London, you make three films on Queen Elizabeth as an Indian filmmaker in the UK. You are now in a very different industry. It's the British film industry. Again, you're working with the top actors. So before we get into how did that happen, but if you could also just talk briefly about, okay, so how is that industry so different from the Bombay industry or the US industry? You're suddenly literally on another planet, in a sense.
You know, when a surgeon operates, the operation is the same. It's the tools that are different. It's how you get into the operation. So between saying action and cut, it's the same. Sorry. It's how you get to action, how what happens. The politics of filmmaking that are different. The actual making of the film is the same. Right? It's exactly the same. So that's, sometimes I say that, okay, making a film in India is like going to Chor Bazaar. You're not sure about what you're getting. It's chaotic. And then making a film in the West is going to a supermarket. You know exactly what you're getting. Yet, chaos in itself is one of the great provokers of creativity. And order can actually dumb down creativity. So which one is better? I don't know. I like both.
Right. I feel that Bandit Queen also put you on the international stage. Suddenly the international cinema had recognized and acknowledged a film like Bandit Queen. So was that the bridge to be able to get an entry into the British film industry and the producers?
Well, yeah, Hollywood kind of beckoned, but that's not why I went. I had to make up my mind. That at Bandit Queen, I was sitting in a place where every actor in India wanted to work with me. And I just had to decide what I want to do. Do I want to go and pit myself against the A-team? Literally, I said, yeah, go, Shekhar. But everybody said, Bandit Queen did well, so you got Elizabeth. No, 3 years. 3 years of running out of money, living on people's couches, living on people's carpets, and saying, I said, can you get me for this meeting, that? And then being offered Elizabeth, and then me saying no.
Oh.
Yeah, I said no, because I said, I can't do a historical frock film, a costume drama. Can you believe the director of The Banded Queen would do a costume drama? And I said no. And then, of course, my agent called me and said, are you stupid? Hey, what's going on with you? Who the fuck do you think you are? You know, literally, my agent is talking to me like that. And said, every big British director wants to do the film. I said, okay. So I called the producer. I said, look, Tim Bevan is his name, a big producer. Yeah. I said, Tim, there's only one, I don't like British films. He said, well, okay, I'm not happy with British films myself, although he's the biggest producer there. I said, you know what? The only British film I've liked of recent times was Trainspotting. I loved that film.
All right.
And he said, I think you're right. I said, can I make Elizabeth like Trainspotting in that genre? He said, yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay, that's how Elizabeth happened, and that's why it's so different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. No, but it's an incredible that he was game to go along.
I think he was also scared that they'll just come up with another ordinary. So when he saw me fighting so hard against what's been done, or the normality of what a costume or a big historical is, he got even more excited.
Mm. And then you went on to make 3 films. So what was that?
Well, I want to make another one.
Oh, okay.
Because I have a theme that runs through them. Because Elizabeth, see, it's very Eastern. Ultimately, we all come back to who we are. The theme that runs between Elizabeth is it the whole idea of being godlike. She used to believe that kings and queens are ordained by God.
Mm.
Right? She used to really believe that. That's why if you see the second film, there was such a huge issue for her to actually execute Mary of Scots, because she believed she also was a queen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, if you're ordained by God, then what do you do when you're about to die? Mm. Because in death, You're no longer, you're not ordained by God, because then you die like everybody else on this planet. Mm-hmm. So that's the last film. Because true that Elizabeth stood for 16 hours because she believed that she would, if she lay down, she would die.
Oh,
so what went through her mind for the 16 hours of a woman who believed that she was ordained by God to suddenly accept mortality? So that's still another film to do.
Mm, amazing. I hope it yeah. happens soon. And then, of course, by 2022, we are in the middle of the pandemic. And when everybody else is resting at home or stuck at home, you come up with an entirely new film, a totally different genre, a romantic film, but of course, much more than a romantic film. So 2022, What's Love Got to Do With It is really looking at a Pakistani family and a white British neighbor. And, you know, it's easy to call it like the cultural complexity and mix-up of being Pakistani origin in Pakistani British. But I think what you've managed to do in the film is really open up a space which we only see through stereotypes. So all the characters in the film are actually breaking open a certain perception that everybody has of who is a white British girl, who is a brown British man of Pakistani origin, and so on and so forth. And plus, the film gets made in the pandemic. So how does that happen?
Couple of things about that. Remember that Jemima Khan wrote the script, who was married once to Imran Khan. So there was her perception also, although my perception, her perception of was very different, because when I was 19, I was in London. I was experiencing all that with all my
right.
friends and all the him and their white girlfriends. What I was fascinated by and why I wanted to make that film is because of Tinder.
Hmm.
I was trying to understand that. I was trying to really understand how, what are we all looking for as human beings? When we are born, we are held close to our mother's chest. When we die, we want to hold somebody's hand. What we're looking for is intimacy. Mm. And yes, we look for relationships, we look for sexuality. Sexuality is also a way of finding intimacy. But how does Tinder help you? So I remember sitting in this big production office and all the girls, and I said, okay, I'm going to ask you all a very straight question. You don't have to answer if you don't want to. They said, what's the question? I said, how many of you are on Tinder or any other such app? And they all looked at me for stupid. They all raised their hands. So obviously I was out of date. You know? So I wanted to explore how, what are you finding in love, in intimacy, in sharing? Where, what are we looking for? What is this generation? What are we looking for? So it really was the search for how people in this generation look for intimacy and sharing and love and sexuality. So that's why the pairing of one man who says, I don't even want to have sex before I get married. Mm. The other one says, well, how do you know it'll work if you haven't had sex before marriage? What do you do? How can you be a virgin? Yeah. He said, no, that's not the question. It's not about virginity. It's about that. So all these things got mixed up and exploded this whole idea of, you know, what is, where does marriage, where do relationships stand? And that's, I'm just explaining to you, you know, it looks very simple, but actually what led to, what it led out from was my trying to understand a generation that thinks that they are, or maybe they're right. I must be wrong if they're all of it. Yeah. To look for intimacy through dating apps, constant. But what it did was, it gave the power to women.
Yeah.
A woman could now swipe this way or that way and say, I want to have sex with you. Swipe this way. No, I don't want you. Mm-hmm. And nobody judged them for it. That was the biggest thing that was happening. Mm-hmm. We used to judge women. Remember when we judge, oh, she's not, she's a bit loose. And she, there was all gone. No judgment.
Yeah.
That's what's saying. And nobody actually talks about that. Talks about that what these dating apps have done has power of decision-making of that back to women. It was great.
Yeah. And that's really evident in all the three young women in the film.
Yeah.
You know, the sister and the girl he marries and the girl he's actually in love with. All three of them really have agency. They determine their paths.
Yeah.
And that was beautiful. But this is also, talking about Tinder is a good time to talk about, you know, we are now at a cusp of cinema technology that is really it's opening up a Pandora's box, and it's interesting. Sometimes, you know, for people like us who have been trained in a certain understanding of cinema, it's a bit intimidating, but it's also deeply exciting in the world of AI, in the world of social media, in the world of video games, comic. You know, it's every genre and every medium is leaked into each other. At this point in time, what do you think? Where is cinema? What is the future? Where? What are the possibilities? What are the pitfalls? You know, what do you fear? What do you look forward to?
How many of you know that the only reason we have intervals is because the cinema all wants to sell you chips?
Overpriced chips.
Overpriced chips. That's why we make long films.
Yeah.
Our length of film is decided by the need for the cinema theater owner to have an interval. So what is that? What am I trying to prove? I'm trying to prove that we tell stories. That's who we are. We're storytellers. And we adapt through cinema, or when we had, you know, the movie camera. Now we have digital, all of that. We adapt to the technology that is offered to us. Mm-hmm. And that technology creates a cultural relationship with the audience. I remember as a kid saying, well, we used to, you know, now think about this. It's summer in Delhi, hot.
And
you go in and somebody says, the film is 12 reels. Everybody will boo because they don't have enough time in the air-conditioned hall.
Yeah.
And if it's 18 reels, there would be an applause because they can sit in the hall longer. So we are conditioned by the technology that we are being offered. And now AI is a new technology. I really love it because it'll democratize cinema filmmaking. And you then don't need to make a film because you want to tell a big scale film. I just yesterday was judging AI Film Festival in Dubai. All the films were poetic. Mm. They were about poems. They were beautiful. And now my competition is not going to be with the big Hollywood filmmakers. It's going to be with a 15-year-old kid sitting in a slum like Dharavi in Bombay, working on a computer with prompts and make the most beautiful film. He's probably more motivated than I am because he's hungry. Or she's hungry, and she's angry, and she's, you know, she's, and her parents said, this is not what you can do. And she's rebelling against everything, and she's just typing, and she's creating a film with Sora or whatever new thing comes out. Now, that doesn't have need to be a three-hour film. So we'll adapt. Cinema as a storytelling medium will constantly adapt and adapt and adapt to the technologies offered and grow.
Right. But you don't feel that in the process of AI, there is a chance that the storyteller gets lost? You don't think that might...
Well, nobody would want to watch that film. I mean, we've seen enough big Hollywood films or Bollywood films, if you like to call it, where the storyteller gets lost and nobody wants to see the film.
Right.
At least here the cost of failure is low, right?
Yeah. So I have one last question before we open it up to the audience. And the question is that today, in a sense, your last film in India, in Bombay, was 1994. So today, so many decades later, the face of the Hindi film industry and all the other regional film industries as well has changed. It is no longer the industry of the 80s and the 90s where the money was dubious, the producers, we didn't know where the money came from. It was totally informal. It's still star-driven, but it was star-driven at another level. But today we have a slightly more corporatized industry, a very different kind of idea of marketing, of everything. It's a totally transformed industry. Is this an industry you're curious about? Do you want to engage with it? Is this interesting? Is it not? Or what are your views on that?
Well, you're talking about the studio system has come to India.
Yeah, it's...
Right, effectively.
The Hollywood type, yeah.
The people that used to give you money on 3% a month and you used to get bankrupt, but that person will give you money again because you couldn't pay the interest. That means as long as you kept losing the other person's money, you could go on making films. There was an inherent idea in that. But they were very respectful of you.
Mm.
I remember meeting them. They loved the business. They loved films. And they looked up to you because you were the person that was going to make the money for them. I remember just sitting for hours in front. And we did not respect them because they were dhotis.
Mm.
Now they all wear suits. Now, it doesn't matter. It does, yeah. We've come out of the black market economy into the... That's good. But I am constantly saying, this is also in Hollywood, by people who have no idea of creativity.
Yeah.
Are now trying to tell you how to make a film. Now, if somebody asks me, very honestly, all of you ask me, when you go on the sets, how do you shoot a film? And I'm telling you right now is, I don't know. If I knew, I would make a terrible film. The moment keeps telling me how to make a film. And yet behind me in that monitor, there are 7-8 people who know exactly how to shoot the film or how it should be shot.
Yeah.
Who are those people? Because if they really, really understood creativity, they would not know. And they would accept that they would not know. They would understand that creativity is an aspiration. Creativity is a longing, not a knowing. And they come and say, we know. They sit in a meeting and say, we know. And said, no, you don't.
Yeah.
So I have a special way of dealing with them in Hollywood. I shoot so fast that when they come to me, say, Mr. Kapoor, Shekhar, say, what? I don't have time. You know you're running out of budget. You're running out of schedules. So the idea is to keep shooting so fast. It's like going to war. You know, if you have a prime minister coming to you and say, well, actually, you shouldn't point your guns this way. You say, no, no, but the bullets are coming. Get out. You'll get shot. Come on. That's what, just ramp up the speed of your shots, or at least give the illusion of doing that.
Yeah. That's lovely.
Diplomacy, right? Right?
That's a lovely thought, that creativity is actually, art making is about not knowing. If you know, then where's the art?
That's true of everything.
It's beautiful.
We look back at my life, what did I know against what actually happened?
Right.
I can say it happened. I can also say I did not know it was going to happen.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I think now it's a good time to open it up to the audience. There are two of us.
You've been listening to a download from the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. You'll find more information on our website, www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.